Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on an interstellar road trip. Welcome to Route 51, regional talk radio for north central Wisconsin. I'm Glenn Moberg. Today, we are riding a highway to the heavens as the subject turns to outer space and the question of whether there is life on other planets. We're welcoming into our Wisconsin Public Radio studios Dr. Maggie Turnbull, also known as the Northwood Space Girl. Dr. Turnbull has a unique profession. She is a freelance astrobiologist who has moved back to her hometown of Antigo, where she is forming a new organization, the Global Science Institute. Dr. Turnbull, as an astronomer with the Carnegie Institute, has created a database of potentially habitable star systems, which could be used as a target list for NASA's upcoming Terrestrial Planet Finder mission. Her work has been published in both scientific and popular journals, and she is in demand as an authority on the subject of extraterrestrial life. Have you seen the stars
tonight? Would you like to go up on a deck and look at them with me? Have you seen the stars tonight? Would you like to go up for a stroll and keep me company?
Today we ask for your opinions. Is there life on other worlds? What about nearby Mars, with evidence of large-scale flowing water in its recent geological history? What about the moons of Jupiter and Saturn? And what about the billions upon billions of other star systems in our universe? What do you think of America's space program? Of NASA? Should we be exploring other worlds? Should we be returning to the moon? And what of our recent missions? From the stunning pictures sent back by the robotic Mars Pathfinders to yesterday's shooting down of a spy satellite, should space be a final frontier for peace or for weapons of war? As always, we invite you to join the conversation at 261-6371, 261-6371, or toll free at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. And our lines are open. Maggie Turnbull, welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio and Route 51.
Hi, Glenn.
Did you go out and see the lunar eclipse last night?
Yes, I absolutely did. It was cold.
And clear.
And it was completely clear and fabulously beautiful. It was amazing. I actually watched it with my grandmother, who's staying with us for a while in Antigo.
We live out in the country in Merrill, and my 12-year-old son and I went outside and turned off all the lights in the house, and it was amazing as the last sliver of light went away, how all of the stars leaped up in the sky, and you could see everything clearly.
That really shows you how much the moon competes with the stars in the sky. The astronomers, you know, we call that bright time, and that's sort of the time of the month when the full moon is out is when folks who really just study bright things try to get telescope time on the big telescopes. But that dark time when the moon is just a sliver or you have a new moon, that's really the highest priority, high demand time to try to get telescope time. And you can see why.
Well, just from your backyard, there is so much light pollution now. Even in northern Wisconsin, there are so many lights, car dealerships, places where instead of shining those lights down on the parking lot where they conceivably do some good lighting up the cars in the lot, You're shining light way up into the sky, and you're blotting out the view of the heavens for everyone.
They're shining all over the place. And in this area, I guess we haven't really invested a lot in trying to preserve dark skies. In Tucson, Arizona, where I went to graduate school and lived for 6 years, there actually are quite a few ordinances in place to try to limit that. So even right in the middle of this huge urban sprawl of Tucson, Arizona, you really can see quite a few stars thanks to that. Just simple measures that, gas stations and other companies will put in place to keep that light shining down and not up into the sky.
And really, who gives a private business the right to take away your view of the sky?
I know.
But money talks, I guess. But you've moved back to the North Woods of Antigo. You grew up in Antigo, or at least spent some time there during your childhood?
I lived in Antigo from 7th grade through 12th grade, and I consider it to be my hometown.
What brought you back?
The woods. I think it was the woods that brought me back. I love the woods. I love northern Wisconsin. I love the winter. I love the extremities of all four seasons. You know, it's like a different planet every 3 months here. And there's just so much variety and so many interesting things going on. And I think, you know, the other thing is having had a chance to live in completely different environments and in much, much bigger cities. I really appreciate the way people interact in this part of the country. And,
what?
Well, I mean, for example, I went to the grocery store and I was in line and I was getting my credit card out to pay. And, the woman at the register said, "Now, do you have a key card?" And I didn't have a key card. So she said, "Oh, that's okay. We'll just use mine." And after she printed out the receipt, she had forgotten to swipe the card. And she said, "Oh, my goodness, I forgot to swipe the card. Well, you just hold on. I'm going to call the manager, and he's going to come over here and authorize." So the manager comes over and gives me $1.29 or something like that and apologizes to me for forgetting to do that. Meanwhile, the guy behind me in line says, "You know, next time you could just, use my card."
Yeah, and you know, people who grew up here, who spent their whole lives here, many don't realize that it's not that way in the big cities.
No, in Washington, in D.C., I never, ever, ever would something like that happen. And that just the fact that I remember that kind of shows you how unusual of an experience that would be in D.C.
So you like the woods. You have some pets. I've been on your blog.
Got a couple dogs, couple family dogs. They're living at my parents' house. They technically belong to my parents, although I have adopted them as my soul dogs.
You're doing some snowshoeing?
We're doing lots of snowshoeing, spending a lot of time out there. I actually had a cousin come up from Milwaukee, and we went sledding and sledded on 5 different hills in Wausau before we finally decided that the hill in my parents' backyard is just as good as any of those.
So we understand why anybody who's sane would prefer the lifestyle of north central Wisconsin or the North Woods. But how can you make a living here as an astrobiologist?
Well, this is a question I've actually been asking myself for years now, because I've really wanted to come back for a while, and I really treasure the experiences that I've had in other parts of the country, and really love D.C. too, by the way, but just have always known that that's not the kind of place I want to settle in. But the question has been, well, how can I make money? How can I survive? And I finally just, a few months ago, I finally just said, I don't know the answer to that question, but if I don't try, I'm not going to find out. And my colleagues have generally said, you can't just go be a freelance astrobiologist. Who's going to hire you? Who's going to work with you? And I'm going to answer that question by living it. And so far, it seems like it could actually work.
Have you always had an interest in astronomy?
Yes. I think I was actually born on another planet and just raised here. When I was little, I do remember my first exposure to other planets was looking at this little encyclopedia of planets and just these pictures of Saturn and Jupiter and other planets, and just thinking that it was just so interesting and exotic. And how could you not wonder about that?
You graduate from high school in Antigo?
I did, yeah.
And where do you go from there?
From there, I went to the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and got a degree in astronomy. And then I went to the University of Arizona and got a PhD in astronomy and a PhD minor, actually, in biology, because by that time I was really interested in this question of life.
And you've been working with the Carnegie Institute. Tell us about your work there.
Right. Well, the first job I got out of grad school was with the Carnegie Institution of Washington. And I moved there and worked with them for 2 years and had the pleasure of working with some field biologists as well as other astronomers. It's an interesting mix of people, just a small institute, but rich in intellectual capability and in the adventurous nature of their scientists there. I did go up to the island of Svalbard, which of course has now been made famous by this movie. What's the name of that movie where they all have demon animals? Maybe somebody can call in and tell us the name of that movie. It just came out.
261-6371 or 1-800-780-9742 if you know the name of that movie.
Right. Well, anyway, that movie takes place in the island of Svalbard, which is a real place, people. And I went there. It's up near the North Pole, and we were tracking around glaciers, hot springs, ancient fossilized ancient lake beds, looking for organisms that were once living there and for organisms that are currently living actually inside the ice that's there today.
So these organisms could conceivably live in a place like Mars, for instance.
Like Mars, or maybe, for instance, Europa, Jupiter's moon that's covered with ice, but underneath that ice probably has more salty ocean water than we have here on our entire planet.
You were also influenced by another movie that we were talking about, Contact.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Contact is like a pivotal moment in my life. When I saw that movie, I was actually a junior in college, and I was doing an internship at Harvard in Boston, so it was really my first time living outside of Wisconsin. And that movie came out. I saw it 4 times in the theater. The first time I saw it, I was practically standing on my chair, pointing at the screen, saying, "That is what I'm supposed to do." And I just knew from that moment when I saw that movie that this was the kind of thing that I wanted to study in my life. I wanted to find life on other planets. And it's an interesting story because I just sort of filed that away as this is what I'm going to do with my life. But I didn't quite know how to get there. So I just kind of filed it away and continued with my studies. But a year later, I met the woman who Jodie Foster's character is based on. And her name is Jill Tarter. She runs the SETI Institute in Northern California.
That stands for Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence.
Right. And at the time when I met Jill, I didn't know anything about this connection between her and the movie, that the movie was at all based on her or anything like that. But I just knew that she did what I wanted to do. And so I persuaded her to let me come and work for them the summer after my first year in graduate school. And I distinctly remember this moment where I was sitting there working and Jill was off at this big, important, fancy conference in Hawaii. And here I was working my fingers to the bone on creating a new target list for SETI and pulling all this data together. And I had so many questions. And I thought, I really need to be at that conference. I can't believe I'm sitting here by myself. And I looked over and I saw this picture of Jill and Jodie Foster standing in front of the Arecibo radio telescope. Uh-huh. And it all came full circle, and I realized I was exactly where I was supposed to be. And then I ended up working with her for the next 6 years on my dissertation.
And you put together a target list.
Right.
Tell us about that target list.
I put together a new target list to be used on the new SETI telescope, the Allen Telescope Array, which is an array of radio dishes.
So this is a target list in the search for extraterrestrial intelligence?
Right. Which stars are we going to point at is the question. If we have this, if we're building this new telescope, the Allen Telescope Array, and we have this precious telescope time, what do we want to spend that time looking at in order to really answer this question? Is there life like us somewhere else in the universe beaming radio signals in our direction? So I really thought hard about that. And well, what do we know right now about the stars? And, you know, there aren't that many astronomers these days that really focus on nearby stars. That's just kind of boring stuff. You know, most astronomers are more like, oh, black holes or newly forming planets or stuff like that.
They're looking for the big questions. How was the universe created?
Right.
You're looking for another big question.
Right.
Is there anybody like us out there?
Yeah. Which when you come down to it, you end up having to look at some pretty mundane things. Well, what are the nearest stars? And are they anything like the sun? And what are the things about the sun that make this environment so good for us to live here?
How many targets did you find? How many potentially inhabitable star systems that are in our physical backworld, backwoods, you might say, a place that's not too far away from the Earth, but that still might hold life forms?
Well, I started with a list of about 180,000 stars, and I was kind of limited in that there are some things we really need to know in order to even be able to ask that question. And one of those things is we need to know how far away each star is. And that turns out to actually be not easy to answer. How far away is that star? But we did have a catalog from the European Space Agency's Hipparchos mission that had a list of 120,000 stars where we knew exactly how far away those stars were. And I whittled that down. I applied all my criteria of what is necessary in order for a star to be considered a habitable stellar system. And having applied all my criteria, I ended up with a list of, 17,000-18,000 stars that are really good.
17,000 or 18,000 that might hold life like ours in their star system.
Right.
What do you think the likelihood is? Do you think there is life on other planets?
Yes, I do. Well, when you have that many options, you know, you have that many choices of places to live, that much good real estate, there's got to be something out there. Now, granted, a lot of those stars we don't know that much about, and the closer we look, the less attractive they seem.
We're talking to Maggie Turnbull. She's an astrobiologist. She lives in Antigo, and she's looking for extraterrestrial life. We want to hear from you. 261-6371 or 1-800-780-9742. I'm Glenn Moberg. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio on the Ideas Network.
Contributors to Wisconsin Public Radio include attorney Paul A. Sturgill, serving the legal needs of the elderly and their families throughout Wisconsin and Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Toll-free information is at 888-613-0600.
For more information on regional programming for North Central Wisconsin here at Wisconsin Public Radio, or to have your community event listed with us, check out our local website at wpr.org/WLBL.
Your business can reach an audience like no other in Wisconsin by supporting programming on Wisconsin Public Radio. For more information about business sponsorships, call Rick Ryer at 1-800-749-3906.
You're listening to Route 51 Regional Talk Radio on the Ideas Network. The subject today, is there life on other worlds? Our guest, Maggie Turnbull, she's an astrobiologist who lives in Antigo, who's compiled a list of star systems that it's being used by NASA to determine where they're aiming those radio telescopes to try to figure out where there might be life, intelligent life that might be beaming signals back to us. Maggie, you just did a Canadian Public Radio interview, in fact, in this very studio here in Wausau this past week, on what it will take to find aliens. Well, what will it take?
It's going to take commitment, first of all. Right now, I think, you know, that's not really the highest priority on NASA's list right now. And if, you know, I think that NASA really does need a vision and a motivation for its activities that inspires people and would result in discovery that really changes the world. And the idea of finding life on another planet, I think, would be an excellent central theme for a lot of NASA's activities.
There's a poll on your website on how to define NASA's mission. Should we send people to the moon, Mars, or beyond? Should we find life on other worlds? Do we robotically explore the solar system? Do we study the rest of the galaxy and beyond? Those questions aren't mutually exclusive, except as far as funding is concerned. There's only so much money that goes around. What would you like to see?
I think I obviously would like to see a focus on finding life on another planet, but that's a pretty big umbrella. That means missions to Mars. That means missions to Europa. That means going back to Titan again, Saturn's moon Titan. It means dedicating time and funding toward listening for intelligent signals, either in radio waves or at optical wavelengths. It means trying to find Earth-like planets around nearby stars. And that, I think, is probably one of the most exciting realms of discovery that is currently not very well funded, actually, at NASA, in spite of the huge impact that that kind of study could have.
261-6371 or 1-800-780-9742. If you want to speak to Maggie Turnbull, let's go to Jim in Wausau. Jim, you're on Route 51. Hello, Jim.
Hello. I'd like your expert to discuss an article in the February issue of Discover magazine, which talks about a theory that the origin of life on Earth may have, or any extraterrestrial planet, might begin in ice-type climates rather than in hot oceans, as has typically been said. And if so, wouldn't that expand the number of planets or planetary systems where life would be possible?
I'm not familiar with that, Jim. Are you familiar with the study, Maggie?
I actually haven't read the article. It sounds pretty interesting, though.
Because you always hear, you know, the old soup on the kitchen stove.
Sure.
Analogy, the primordial stew, and that's where you get the molecular behavior that leads to the DNA.
Sure.
And the RNA rings.
This idea that life could actually originate in icy environments as opposed to hot environments could potentially expand the number of possibilities for life getting started elsewhere. The universe is a very cold place. There aren't a lot of places with vast expanses of warm liquid water sitting around. So that requirement, if life does require warm water, or liquid water, in order to get going, a lot of liquid water, then we're really limited to only certain areas around stars and within planets themselves.
So, Jim, it's your impression in reading that article that could vastly increase the likelihood that there is life out there.
Yes, for exactly what was said, because cold is more common than heat. The article hypothesizes that as ice freezes out, the remaining solution is more concentrated, and so the life-producing chemicals, even though molecular reactions are slower at the lower temperature, because it's more concentrated, they're closer to one another, and that offsets the lower temperature, and it is accurate.
Fascinating. Jim, we've got to take a break for news. You're listening to Route 51 Regional Talk Radio for North Central Wisconsin. Jim, thanks so much for the phone call. We're talking to astrobiologist Maggie Turnbull of Antigo about the possibility of life on other worlds. 261-6371 or 1-800-780-9742. We'll be back after this.
Woke up this morning with light in my eyes, and then realized it was still dark outside. It was a light coming down from the sky. I don't know who or why. Must be those strangers that come every night. Those saucer-shaped lights put people uptight. Leave blue-green footprints that glow in the dark. I hope they get home all right. Spaceman, won't you please take me along? I won't do anything wrong. Hey, Mr. Spaceman, won't you please take me along?
You're listening to Route 51 Regional Talk Radio on the Ideas Network. I'm Glenn Moberg. Our guest today, Maggie Turnbull, an astrobiologist who lives in Antigo as she forms a new organization called the Global Science Institute, and she continues her research into whether there is life on other worlds. Our phone number is 261-6371 or 1-800-780-9742. If you'd like to talk to Maggie, if you've got questions about the search for extraterrestrial intelligence or just plain extraterrestrial life, let's go to Dave in Weston. Dave, you're on Route 51.
Well, hi. Thank you for taking my call, and it's really nice to know that we have an expert up in northern central Wisconsin on a topic that I enjoy very much.
Thanks.
Maggie, here's a question I have. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, you know, the actual sun that's in our solar system and comparing it to some other stars. From my reading, if I remember correctly, our sun is fairly small compared to a lot of the others. And, you know, I'm just wondering, as you're doing your looking, does the size of the star make a difference? And
yes.
Are we just in a real freaky spot where we're in a where we have a very small star and our planet is in a very close proximity to it and it works out really well? And if that is the case, is that what you're looking for elsewhere, or are you looking for other stars that are quite a bit larger, and then you got to figure planets that are going to be, you know, much further away because of its size?
Okay, yeah. First of all, let me clarify this. The sun is not by any means a large star. The sun is definitely one of the smaller stars in the galaxy. However, smaller stars in the galaxy are actually more common, and the sun is not by any means one of the smallest stars either. The range of masses for stars goes to from about a tenth of the mass of the sun up to about 200 times the mass of the sun at the very highest. And we don't have any of those 200 solar mass stars in this neighborhood, thank goodness. But most of the stars in the galaxy are, you know, they're like grains of sand, these faint little stars that you cannot see with your eyes, even though they are the closest ones to us outside of the sun, of course. But sun-like stars, you know, the same mass as the sun, are still fairly common. They're not the most massive. They're not the least massive. But there's a lot of them in the galaxy to choose from. So the thing that's key about the mass of the star is that it has direct consequences on how long that star will survive peacefully. As you probably have noticed, the sun is the same every day. And you don't get up and sometimes in the morning it's twice the size of what it used to be or half as bright. Other stars are variable stars, and as you go to higher and higher masses, they also burn through their fuel much more quickly and do not live as long. The sun is 5 billion years old. It's been burning hydrogen fairly stably almost that entire time. And life on Earth has had, therefore, that long to evolve and become more complex and more customized to this particular environment. Now, other more massive stars are not going to live as long. In fact, if you really only get, say, twice as massive as the sun, not even less than that, now you're talking about stars that don't even live 1 billion years. So, you know, two times the mass of the sun, that's still not a very big star. But
life on Earth has been around for longer than a billion years.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, at least 3.8-ish billion years. So that 1 billion years may just not be enough time for complex life to get organized, and certainly not enough time for a whole civilization to spring up, at least not if that process proceeds in the same way that it has on our planet in the past. So the mass of the star really does matter quite a lot.
Dave, did she answer your question?
Yeah, she did. And just one follow-up, and then I'll hang up. So as you are doing your searches, are you looking for stars that have very similar mass and makeup to our sun? And then I'll hang up, and I appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Dave.
You bet.
Well, what we do is prioritize. We have sort of ranges of these different parameters. So when we're talking about the mass of the star, you know, I mentioned 1.5 to 2 times the mass of the sun. That's getting to be a little bit too massive for communicating life to live around just because they don't live long enough. But lower than this, lower mass than the sun, smaller stars than the sun, they live longer, and there really isn't a reason to rule them out. So we have sort of a range of masses that we consider to be just fine, something like a tenth of the mass of the sun all the way up to 1.5 to 2 times the mass of the sun. And within that, since we can only point the telescope in one part of the sky at a time, what we do is we prioritize according to these different parameters. And we do prefer the stars that are the most like the sun. So they sort of float to the top of the list in terms of priority.
Let's talk about the planets surrounding our own sun. We've already mentioned Mars. Weren't you excited about those robotic Mars missions and those beautiful pictures that came back?
Absolutely. I am an expert in the stars. So if folks want to ask detailed questions about these rover missions, I may not be the best person to ask. But I think that these rovers have been so interesting, and especially in their searches to find evidence for water on the surface of Mars.
And there was water on Mars.
Yes, there was. There just isn't another good explanation for why we see these kinds of features on the surface. It's not clear at this point whether there were large bodies of water sitting around for long periods of time on Mars. It could very well be that there were episodes of melting, perhaps underneath the surface of Mars, and that broke forth and gave rise to these little river channels and features that we do see. But at some point, and not in necessarily very in the very distant past, there was water on the surface
of
Mars.
How long ago?
It looks like within the past million years or so, there was water flowing.
There were people around a million years ago, so that's
right.
Not very long ago at all. Well, where would you look for life on Mars? Because there clearly aren't large bodies of water on the planet now, at least not where we can see them.
Right. You know, what I would do is, I'm not planning these missions to Mars. There are other people who have thought a lot harder about this stuff than I have, but what I would do is I would identify some of these regions where it looks like there have been episodes of water flowing out of the surface in the recent past, and I would target those areas, especially in sometimes what you'll see is in the walls of craters on Mars, you'll see certain layers where it looks like there water has seeped out from the crater wall periodically and even pooled up in the bottom of those craters before freezing or evaporating. And those craters, I think, would be some of the most interesting places to go.
What do you think, and I know that this is a question that you don't have a definite answer for, but what's the likelihood of finding viral, bacterial, or one-cell life on Mars, or maybe something more complex?
72.5%. I'm not real sure what the likelihood is. All I can say is that, you know, Mars and the Earth have exchanged material in the past. And we know this, that this is an ongoing process. The planets are not isolated from one another, technically, because we do find Martian meteorites on Earth from time to time. And if there are organisms on Mars, say, for example, even surviving today in some underground water table, I wouldn't be surprised if those organisms were related in some way, perhaps distantly related to organisms on Earth. And some scientists believe, in fact, that life may have gotten started on Mars and migrated to Earth.
But doesn't that just push everything back, because then you
right.
have to ask, how did it start on Mars?
Exactly. It doesn't answer, I mean, it does say, you know, how did life on Earth get here, but it doesn't answer the ultimate question of how did life start at all.
Should we be sending people to Mars, a manned mission, do you think?
Well, at this time, I'm not really a huge proponent of that. I think it would be fabulous to get to go to Mars. I'd love to do that. But when you consider how the investment that will take in terms of just dollars and time and just, you know, man and woman power to get there, there is so much amazing and really interesting science we could be doing for that price tag in the meantime right now. We have not tapped out the promise of our current capabilities. So I would hate to see, you know, the whole vision of NASA, for example, get derailed just for the purpose of putting, you know, boots on Mars.
the moons of Jupiter or Saturn are other potential spots where life could have evolved.
Right. There are a couple of interesting places there. Europa, Jupiter's moon, is, I think, one of the most interesting places in the entire solar system when we're talking about life on other worlds in the solar system. Europa is completely covered with ice, but the interior of Europa is warmed by the fact that it is in orbit around Jupiter, and it's in a slightly elliptical orbit because of the other moon, the influences of the other moons orbiting Jupiter. And this constant push and pull as it goes around Jupiter is warming the interior. And we can see that there is liquid water circulating underneath that ice.
And Jupiter actually generates heat. It's such a big big planet.
Jupiter actually radiates more energy than it receives from the sun.
And what about Saturn?
Saturn, well, there is Titan, which is this fascinating world that looks totally different from all the other moons.
Incidentally, I recommend The Sirens of Titan by Kurt Vonnegut if you want definitive proof that there's life on that planet.
Yeah, well, we now know that there are bodies of liquid methane on the surface of Titan. And there are weather systems, probably methane rainstorms that happen on that planet, river channels carved by episodes of rain downfall.
But this is methane rain?
This is methane.
So you would need a different kind of a chemical life base in order to life there. It wouldn't be based on oxygen and carbon. It would be based on methane.
Right. It was a totally different basis for life. The thing that's so wonderful about water is that it's an asymmetrical molecule. So the charge, there are actually positive and negative sides to that water molecule. And this enables all kinds of rich chemistry to occur in water as a medium that you wouldn't necessarily have in methane. But that doesn't mean it's impossible. And methane is obviously rich in energy. I mean, it's natural gas that we use that here on Earth to fuel a part of our society. But, in terms of what kind of life, could life actually use that as a medium? I don't know. It's an interesting question.
Maggie Turnbull, she's an astrobiologist. She lives in Antigo. She's with us for about another 10 minutes. If you'd like to call and ask her about the search for extraterrestrial life, 261-6371, or 1-800-780-9742, 780-9742. I'm Glenn Moberg. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio on the Ideas Network.
Hello, Wisconsin. This is Leanne Hansen, host of Weekend Edition Sunday from NPR News. Please join me at the Wisconsin Public Radio Central Region's Listener Dinner in Stevens Point on March 4th. Please call 800-749-3906 for reservations.
You get enough jargon and double talk in the rest of your life. Why would you want it with your science news? I'm Ira Flatto. Each week on Science Friday, we skip the bogus and buzzwords and don't dumb down the big issues in science, medicine, technology, and the environment. So join me on Science Friday as we discuss science sensibly. That's on Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
And we are discussing science sensibly right here on Route 51. Our guest, Maggie Turnbull, an astrobiologist who lives in Antigo. And let me give you those phone numbers if you'd like to join the conversation in the few minutes we have remaining. 261-6371 or 1-800-780-9742. Maggie, we've got continuing reports of UFOs, people who are sure there's a cover-up in Roswell, New Mexico, people who swear they've seen extraterrestrial spacecraft over major cities. Presidential candidate Denis Kucinich even said he's seen a flying saucer. Are all these people hallucinating, or is there something to it?
Okay. Look, I have the answer. We can solve this problem. I'm glad this question came up because, I can't tell you, and no scientist is going to be able to tell you if you call them up or email and say, look, I saw this thing in the sky. It went like this and then that, and then it was gone. I'm not going to be able to tell you what that was, but somebody out there has got to invent the following thing so that we can finally settle this question once and for all. What we need is a pocket spectrograph. See, if you take a picture of something and it's this white thing in the sky, I have no idea what that is. But if you take a spectrum, I can tell you what it's made of. I can tell you if it's rotating. I can tell you how fast it's moving. I might be able to tell you what that is. So somebody out there, some smart engineer, has to come up with a way that people can carry around their little UFO pocket spectrographs so we can start identifying what these things are. And we can answer this question once and for all in the next 10 years. Are the aliens here or not?
A pocket spectrograph.
Yes.
Something that will be a Christmas stocking stuffer 20 years from
Absolutely.
Now.
Absolutely. Some enterprising person out there is going to invent this, and I hope they kept me in.
Talk about the 37 Gem in the Gemini system. That's one of these stars that you have identified as being one that might possibly harbor life.
Sure. Well, this is where interacting with the press can be really interesting because I think, you know, there are a number of stars in the neighborhood that really float to the top of our list, and that is one of those stars. And it's very much like the sun. There's nothing about it that would preclude the possibility of an Earth-like planet orbiting around that star. And it's therefore one of our top targets. But, you know, when somebody is writing an article about this for a newspaper, they ask you the question, well, you know, what's one of your favorite stars? And of course, I want to come up with one that people could potentially see with their eyes, or at least with
a
small telescope.
Yeah,
yeah, binoculars. And that happened to be one that I picked. And then pretty soon there were articles all over the whole entire world about how Turnbull says this star has, if any star has life around it, it's this one. And, but, you know, I think that's good, you know.
How far away is 37, Jim?
Oh, goodness.
How many light years?
Not, you know, I haven't actually looked at that in a while, but it can't be more than a handful of light years away parsecs away.
But a handful of light years is a long, long distance. And, you know, these distances are so vast. First of all, nobody can travel as fast as the speed of light, which is very, very fast, 186,000 miles per second. The many light years that it takes to get from one spot to another in the universe, doesn't that pretty much preclude space travel from different star systems?
I don't know. I mean, you just have to be patient sometimes, you know. if we had, you know, instead of going to the moon, I'm not saying that the Apollo, you know, program wasn't awesome. It completely was. But say at that same time, you know, if we had launched something to get to another star system, we could be arriving at Alpha Centauri right now. And I'm not saying people would have to be on board, but wouldn't it be interesting if we had a camera or some kind of probe going to another star system, even just to see what the other stars look like up close, because we're not able to image other stars the way we can image the sun.
Tell us about the Global Science Institute, this idea you've got that you want to create in Antigo.
Right. So right now the Global Science Institute is it exists right here in this chair, in this studio, exists in my mind. But this is something that I want to build in the community of Antigo, Wisconsin. And the idea is to actually found something that is perhaps having nonprofit status, able to write proposals and receive grants from the federal government and actually carry out cutting edge science like this from the North Woods of Wisconsin, and actually have educational programs, outreach, perhaps internships, you know, work like this. There are thousands of opportunities for students to get involved in work like this. There are so many different projects that I wish I had time to do, and other young people, perhaps college-bound people, perhaps university students who are home for the summer, could certainly get involved in work like this.
You mentioned science and our kids. How do we get children interested in science?
I guess, you know, how did I get interested in science? Science fiction movies, science fiction TV shows, books. You know, I feel like kids do have a natural affinity for this, especially this particular topic, but even the broader umbrella of science really captures the imagination, just because it brings up so many possibilities of what we could be doing in the future and what they could be working on in the future. But I feel like, you know, it wouldn't hurt to get more scientists, at professional scientists, into the classrooms and showing kids, you know, what kinds of things they do work on. That's not a huge part of our culture in academia. You know, we don't all take a lot of time to actually get involved in stuff like that. I try to because I really enjoy it. But it's something we have to start really valuing, and especially for, I would say, girls, you know, girls are certainly smart enough to do this kind of stuff. And I would say, just don't be afraid. Don't be intimidated to chase down anything that interests you.
How do you deal with people who simply don't value science, or in some cases, they're actually hostile to it? School boards that refuse to teach evolution because it conflicts with religious beliefs. People who tell you that the Earth is only 5,000 years old, ignoring the geological evidence that it's 4.5 billion years old. How do you get through to these people?
Well, look, I mean, nobody has a handle on exactly what has happened in the history of this planet. Nobody has a handle on what the meaning of it all, what the purpose of our existence here is. But this is a process of discovery, and it's an honest process of discovery. We're not out to brainwash anybody, but we want to give people the opportunity to learn how to ask questions for themselves and to think critically and to kind of, you know, just put out those challenging ideas and pursue them rather than being forced to simply recite the party line, whether you're talking about a religious perspective or a science has dogma too. But we don't want kids to be able to recite facts and figures. We want them to be able to learn and to think and to ask questions.
It's the idea of free inquiry.
Exactly.
Maggie Turnbull, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
There's a star man waiting in the sky. He'd like to come and meet us, but he thinks
we want to thank today's guest, Dr. Maggie Turnbull of the Global Science Institute of Antigo, Wisconsin. You can find out more about her at whizspacegirl.blogspot.com. I'm Glenn Moberg of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, and our on-air producer, Kelson Quisler. Today's musical selections by David Bowie, The Birds, The Ventures, and Paul Kantner and Jefferson Starship. Next week, we talk about trial lawyers with Christine Bremer-Moogley, the new president of the Wisconsin Association for Justice. Thanks for riding with us today. Until next week, we're achieving liftoff and heading out of town.